So this is talking with, oops, it's not, yeah. This is talking with Fred Lahaney on 13 March 78 at the National Measurements Laboratory in Sydney. Can you tell me how you first came to radio physics and then how you eventually became involved with radio astronomy?
Yes, well, I was working in industry during the war with Amalgamated Wireless Australasia. And after the war, that particular firm was very confused as to what it could do with the rather large amount of engineering talent it had acquired during wartime.
Right.
This persuaded me that I might try my hand at research rather than industry work, and I took the opportunity to join CSIRO, and my particular job was to join radio physics and initiate the transfer of microwave and radio frequency measurement know-how from that division into the Division of Electrotechnology of the National Standards Laboratory.
I see.
This made me nominally the officer in charge of the so-called test room at the time and brought me directly under the control and influence of Joe Pawsey.
So this was one of the many activities that were engaged in by radio physics after the war, this test room.
The test room was a direct result of the war. That's the way they'd organized their work. And in point of fact, they were in a rather fluid state. The whole division was in a fluid state, trying to identify and pursue the main lines of research appropriate to their background.
Mm-hmm.
You see, as distinct from a lot of the laboratories in Britain and possibly even the USA, there was a very large number of non-academic people still in radio physics. The people from universities had already gone back to their university positions,
mm-hmm.
but there was quite a major number of what I would call non-academic physicists and engineers in radio physics, and they were actively looking for projects to pursue and keep the division together. And of course, one of them, as you might know, was had something to do with navigation. A distance measuring equipment, I think it was called.
Right.
And of course, cloud physics, cloud seeding, and also radio astronomy. So everything was very much in a fluid state when I joined them.
To establish what the role of radio physics was going to be.
Yes, yes. Because, you see, it had no routine commitments like, say, the National Standards Lab had, or it had no well-established traditional program like some of the biological or agricultural divisions in CSIRO. So it was really breaking new ground as a division.
The National Standards Lab, I would guess, is the equivalent of the NBS in America.
That's so, yes, only on a smaller scale.
Yeah.
Yes.
So what did you actually do during the first couple of years after the war at radio physics?
Well, I established some fairly modest research programs, mainly concerned with noise generators in the few hundred megahertz region, and also calibration of thermistors and that type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So the noise generator work, using hot resistors and noise diodes, was very much the sort of calibrating device that radio astronomy needed.
Right.
So it was quite timely in that sense. As you can appreciate, a white noise standard was much better than a single frequency generator to calibrate this equipment, which is essentially measuring fairly white noise.
So, in fact, were you in close contact with the solar noise group, as it was called at that time, for these standards?
Yes, I think they were. I think they were using some of the standards that we had developed.
But it wasn't really their initiative, though, that led you to develop them. You
No, it was the need for these had already existed during the war, and some of these devices were already available. And it was my job and my colleagues' job to refine them or investigate them, see what their limitations were, and improve them.
And so how did you get involved in radio astronomy then, actual research on the...
Well, you couldn't help but be involved in radio astronomy when you had a colleague like Joe Pawsey with you, who was much more interested in natural phenomenon than, say, meeting some formal obligation of providing a measuring service. Although he was an extremely able and quite keen measuring man, in the sense, and he always told me that, or he always appreciated the fact that measurement was fundamental to all these sort of projects, and it was an unfortunate fact of life that the people who produced these tools, measuring instruments and such like, which form such an important part of any project, would never really get the recognition of the people who use them to look at natural phenomena.
Although they probably get more than they at radiophysics than in some other labs.
Well, this was probably the case, because when you look at the old radiophysics program, it was almost entirely an experimental program for many, many years. And it was it was manned by quite brilliant experimental physicists and electronic engineers. But it certainly was mainly experimental.
But it seems to me that the engineers, the people that really built the receivers and so forth, as opposed to the scientists who understood it but were not really the kind of built things, that the engineers also got credit. They were co-authors on papers and so forth.
With few exceptions, they were one and the same thing. You see, the outstanding example of this would be, say, Paul Wild, who built all his own equipment with some help and guidance in the very early days from, say, Lindsay McCready, and, of course, Joe Pawsey, who was a very elegant equipment man in this research sense.
Okay, I should reword that. Virtually everyone, it seems to me, on the early staff did have the background where they had built things and so forth, but usually it seems to me that when you, for instance, Piddington and Minnett, it was Minnett who was doing most of the engineering, Piddington doing most of the interpretation of the measurements.
Yes, yes.
Not that Piddington couldn't have done the engineering, but usually there was some relationship like this.
Well, I don't know. I don't think it's any criticism of Jack to say that he wasn't a particularly good or interested equipment engineer, and to the same extent I would say Frank Kerr, who's now in the States, would be more an interpretive person, interpretive results, but there were very few of them in the old RP days. They were, of course, as you can imagine, they'd all been gathered together for the purpose of making radar equipment.
Right.
And you didn't want interpreters at that stage, you wanted equipment design people. So they were very strong in design and development of equipment.
So you were talking about Pawsey's character and how you were drawn to it, and I guess it drew you right into some measurements of the sun, or how did that come about?
Well, came about in a typically Pawseyan way. And before I really knew what was happening, I suppose it was because I had the noise generators as standards of for calibration work. But before I knew what had happened, I was sort of organized at the team with young Don Yabsley, and I suppose it would probably be as mundane a concept as this, that there was an observing program, and, you know, to keep it going 7 days a week, because the sun shone 7 days a week, you had to have a sufficient number of people to run it.
Right.
And Yabsley and I were a suitable pair to share not only the weekdays, but also the weekend duty. And it was probably as mundane a thing as that, because I wasn't a sort of mad keen radio astronomer, and I never have been, really. But this was an interesting job, and it was perhaps it was my privilege, really, to be sort of sucked into the vortex, as it were, so simply and smoothly. And then, of course, we had this good fortune to have one of these solar storms at an early...
Well, tell me then, what exactly was your project? It looks like you were operating on three different frequencies, 200, 600, 1200.
Well, we were to study the sun and try and correlate the radio frequency noise with whatever other information there was about the sun at that time. And the one of the interesting things about the equipment was that it didn't have a polar axis. So we couldn't follow the sun.
You mean it was an altitude azimuth?
Well, it wasn't.
What kind of aerial was it, first of all?
It was a dish, a fairly crude sort of dish, and it was fed with three dipole arrangements backed by a reflector.
Yeah.
But its it also had an adjustable axis, but it wasn't a polar axis. And what you had to do, you had to, in fact, keep putting the aerial ahead of the sun and let it rest there until the sun went through it. And then you moved it ahead of the sun again.
Right.
And out of this, you got a pattern which increased and became a maximum when the sun just happened to go through the center of the aerial beam.
Right.
So you got a most peculiar picket fence sort of thing.
Right.
And, so you only really saw the sun fully in the beam once a day. And from that, we were our main job was to measure as accurately as we could the temperature of the quiet sun. That was one of the things we hoped to get out of. That was one of the clearly established aims of the project.
I don't follow. You only saw it clearly once a day. I thought that you would be getting several drift curves of the sun as you more or less played leapfrog with it.
That's right, but it only went through the center of the beam twice a day, once in the morning and once in the afternoon.
Was this because it had a fixed elevation?
Yes.
Ah, I didn't catch that. It had a fixed elevation, and you moved it in azimuth, and usually you're on the edge of the beam.
That's right, and but it also had no means of driving the aerial.
Right.
We had to crank it around by hand and let it rest there, and the sun would go through it, so you get this sort of picket fence thing.
Right, growing as it came up on
that's
the center.
That's right, until it came through the center.
How large a dish was this, roughly?
It was probably about 12 feet by 20 feet, I think, something of that order. But a very flimsy sort of construction.
Is this the one that was a straight on one side and curved on the other, straight on two parallel sides?
Yes, I think you're right.
And then curved on the other two sides. Yes I've seen pictures of that, right.
Mm-hmm. And the angle could be adjusted, but certainly not up to a polar axis.
Right, I see. And so, according to the abstract, you published the results in Nature in 1948 and then in the Australian Journal of Scientific Research the following year. You did measure the apparent temperature of the sun at those two frequencies and found that, however, it did not stay constant. Can you tell me, do you remember about that and what you made of that?
I think we tried to correlate it with sunspot activity, but I think it was always suspected that although it didn't stay constant, it did have a basic temperature below which it did not go.
Right.
And that was interpreted as being the temperature of a quiet sun. And I think that turned out to be a fairly constant thing. With the Proviso, however, that in due course, when Piddington got going with his interpretive work, he questioned the absolute value of our temperatures, mm-hmm. and in point of fact, when we looked at our setup again, it was in error because the whole aerial system was not focused at infinity.
Oh, I see.
And there is a small correction note somewhere in the system. You may not have come across it.
An erratum in the Australian Journal?
Yes.
I see.
In which quite significant corrections had to be made to the 1200 megahertz temperatures, which brought them into line with Piddington's predictions.
I see.
From other work. Interesting. We became the odd man out experimentally as far as Piddington was concerned, and he asked for us to recheck.
You mean the spectrum of the sun looked very nice except for this odd
excepting
point?
Excepting for our results, the quiet sun, we were the odd men out, and sure enough, when we checked our results, the aerial had not been adjusted for infinite focus, but I think it was adjusted for the length of the parade ground at George's Heights.
Why? Because you were testing on a transmitter, something like that?
Yes, a finite distance away. Right. And I think we had not thought it would be so vitally important.
Right.
It turned out that it was quite an important correction, particularly at the 1200 megahertz.
So, having done this, and I see that it was 3 months of monitoring, actually, that you did in the middle of 47.
Uh-huh.
I gather then you did not do any more radio astronomy, so this was just a little side project, in a way, is that correct?
That is true. The only additional investigation I did was with Lindsay McCready, when there was some information came from America that there were important, very low frequency signals being generated naturally. A few kilohertz
in the ionosphere.
We weren't too sure where they were generated.
I see.
But I know McCready and I spent a couple of very pleasant summer afternoons out in the Australian bush, trying to get away, we thought, from man-made noise, and seeing if we could pick up some of these very low frequency signals.
I see.
This, of course, was all ways with the encouragement of Joe Pawsey.
Mm-hmm.
Suffice it to say, we didn't get anything that was seemed to us to correlate with anything else, and I think neither McCready nor I were sufficiently inspired to pursue it to the bitter end and, you know, get out somewhere into the centre of Australia.
I see.
We just went out into the local New South Wales bush.
And was the interference still bad?
It seemed to me it was mainly man-made interference we were getting.
Yeah.
Now, I don't know what's happened to this work. I think someone has pursued it.
I haven't heard of that. That's interesting. But you didn't publish anything from your...
No, we didn't publish a negative result, so to speak.
Right.
And I think this information had come by word of mouth from the USA, actually. But it would be a very difficult...
Yeah.
Very difficult job.
And, of course, much more difficult today.
Yes, yes.
Can you just briefly tell me then, I guess then you went back to the work for the National Standards Lab and pretty soon transferred to the other lab?
Yes, I think it was in 48 that I was in fact transferred to the National Standards Laboratory, and the vacancy that resulted from that was filled by Wilbur Christensen.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
I see. Yes. I've talked to him, of course.
He was an old friend of mine from the AWA days.
Oh, yes.
So he came into that vacancy caused by my transfer.
So that was a real contribution to radio astronomy also?
Well, in a peculiar way, yes. Yes.
And the National Measurements Lab came out of the National Standards Lab, is that right?
Yes.
So you've been here ever since?
It's just a change of name. It occurred a couple of 3 years ago when the lab was reorganized.
I'd like to ask you about your impressions of the people and the work style of the Solar Noise Group, as it was called then in the first few years after the war. For instance, you made the remark to me earlier that in the seminal paper by Kwasi McCreedy and Payne Scott, that you, this is a rather unusual grouping of people. Could you sort of tell me about their characters?
Well, Joe, of course, was the most important person in terms of stimulation and also experience. And Joe was had a remarkable physical insight and an almost boyish enthusiasm for just a suck it and see sort of attitude. And this really was the key thing in the whole early days of radio astronomy. Joe's enthusiasm, his tremendous physical insight that made everyone around the place respect him, and a very very nice, pleasant sort of personality, although to some extent a bit naive in dealing with human situations, in a way.
You mean management decisions?
Well, he just didn't like management, but when forced to, he made the necessary decisions, but he just didn't like red tape and the formal problems that you strike in any organization that's well funded by government money, I suppose you could say, or even in a big private lab. I think Joe wouldn't fit happily into the sort of administrative arrangements. But it was his boyishness and his, as I say, tremendous physical insight, and his ability, in fact, his insistence on talking to anyone at any time. You'd suddenly see him sort of pause and say, now I was thinking about that result we talked about the other day. And quite obviously, Pawsey was eating, living and sleeping his research work, which you know, is remarkable in this day and age. But that's the impression I got from Joe, that he was deeply in thought about everything that was happening around him. So he was on the job and inspiring people 24 hours of the day, as it were.
And now what about McCreedy?
Well, McCreedy was a good, solid, fairly conservative electronic engineer, which was an excellent sort of foil for Joe. Joe would have the flashes of brilliance and the string and sealing wax approach to things, and Mac would make sure that it would continue to go, and was a good, reliable bit of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Ruby, on the other hand, was the Ruby was a fairly good theoretician and a fairly woman's lib type of person, I would say, and certainly got the respect of all her male colleagues just because of the power of her intellect, her intellectual capacity.
Mm-hmm. And also she was somewhat liberally oriented, I understand.
Well, yes, she certainly, she was, I suppose, left of center in the political sense, and but also a very critical person. She wouldn't just accept things without well, being critical of them. She was a bit before her time, as far as I say, women's lib is concerned.
But also, you made the interesting remark that once she had decided that she wanted to have a family, apparently, then by golly, she was going to do that right, and she just dropped science and...
Yes, she disappeared from the scene, and when she turned up again almost by accident, I found her actively organizing mothers, and I think at one stage she was the president of Parents and Citizens Group, and also was chosen and was very effectively contributing to some nationally organized group in that field. You know, she had a tremendous intellectual capacity, and once she applied it to motherhood, it was quite effective, I'm sure.
Were you ever part of, there apparently at one stage were monthly meetings of the radio astronomy group, in particular, I think, about progress and what to do next and these sort of things. Do you remember these meetings at all?
I don't think I ever attended any of those. I might have attended one or two, but most of my discussions with were with Joe Poorsey on a sort of casual basis rather than an organized meeting basis.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, a lot of the other people were out at field stations all the time, and I think it would be obviously an advantage to have organized discussions and meetings.
Yeah.
And of course, the other point that was rather important was to make sure that people weren't duplicating each other's work in a new and rapidly growing field. You have this problem of ethics, which probably due to Poorsey's wise guidance didn't rear its head in the early days, certainly, of radio physics.
So, well, there was a case, in fact, where I have heard of several instances where he moved people from one thing to another, or stopped people from doing something because someone else was doing it. So there was some scientific management.
Which apparently, as far as scientific management was concerned, he was right on the ball.
Right.
There's no doubt about it.
But this is still a bit more of an administrative sort of thing, as opposed to giving advice on this experiment. He's more or less keeping people from coming into conflict and so forth. But,
yes. Yes.
So he was able to do that quite well.
Yes, and when he was very sick, in fact, during his last few months of life, he was most disturbed. He was most disturbed at the way the whole science of radio astronomy had grown to such an extent that there was obviously increasing rivalry for support facilities and so on.
Right.
And both Lindsay McCready and I saw a lot of Joe when he was sick in hospital and so on. We used to visit him, and his thoughts were very much along the lines of people like him, and to a less extent myself, should use what influence we've got to stop these rifts and divergences occurring. You know, he was obsessed with the idea that, gee, we've got to all get on together.
Yeah. It was detracting from the science.
It could detract from the total effort,
the
schisms that were developed.
But of course, this was after a period of 3 or 4 years of rather harsh schisms in the radio physics division. So
I suppose they were harsh. I never realized it because I was on the outside, as it were. I was just on the periphery of it. But I suppose it was fairly intense competition for all sorts of things. But I often wonder if it were any worse than in any rapidly developing field of research. You know, I think there must be a very good one-to-one correlation between the intensity of human relationships and the progress in the field at the time. You take the the double helix and so on, the Watson and the Crick and so on. The same sort of intensity existed there, and I think it must go hand in hand with the, importance of the field and the tremendous potentiality of it at any time as far as human contributions concerned.
Well, when people are getting very interesting results, then naturally competition develops and certain intensity.
Well, there are tall poppies everywhere,
right.
Human beings such as they are, you get this conflict, and I don't think the personalities in radio physics were any seriously different from what you'd find anywhere else.
Yeah.
It was just that the circumstances were ripe for this intense rivalry and competition for support.
Well, you mentioned the interesting point that you talked to Poorsey quite a bit near the end of his life. Did he perhaps give any insight to you into why he was going to the States? He was going to have made the decision to become director of the NRAO, as you know.
Yes. One thing he did say to me once, when he did return, he said, I've put certain conditions on my acceptance, and I've warned them that they're not going to see large sums of money quickly spent by me. In other words, he reflected this concern he had always had of spending all your resources on one particular thing. In other words, putting all your eggs in one basket. And I imagine that was his main reason for going to the States. He probably saw another opportunity of doing his pausey thing all over again, you know, the clever piece of innovative research with simple equipment and so on.
That had passed in radio physics because of the coming of the Park Station. It was
going to be a very now, different. Whether in fact Joe would have done this and whether there were such possibilities left is something I'm not at all sure on. You know, time might have caught up with him on a worldwide basis, and he might have had to face up to big telescopes even in Maryland.
I think so.
Yes.
Because in fact at that very time the 140-foot antenna Greenbank was being built and was having tremendous cost overrun troubles and so forth, and I'm afraid he probably would have gotten embroiled in.
Now, if he'd have had to, if he'd have had to face up to a most difficult management situation, which is implied by your comment, I think Joe would have been a most unhappy man.
Yeah, that's my assessment of what probably would have happened.
Yes.
But it's interesting that you say that he apparently was going there expressly with the promise that he would not get involved in that sort of thing.
Well, he told me that he'd warned them, you know, that he might want to oppose or delay the expenditure of large sums of money until he was quite clear in his own mind that it was the right thing
right.
to do.
In which direction to go.
That's right, yes. So he wasn't going to dash madly into large telescopes of any sort. And this is understandable in the light of his background here.
Are there any other comments that you can remember that perhaps as he reminisced on his career or on the growth of radio physics in those last months?
I find it hard to think of anything substantial. He was very grateful. He was very grateful for his pre-war experience. I think it was at EMI, wasn't it?
Yes, in England, yes.
And some of the senior men that he had associated with at EMI and the development of television.
I see.
He was very appreciative of the influence they'd had in his, knowledge of and experience with the techniques that not only suited radar but also suited radio astronomy.
Right.
Due course.
I think he basically became an aerial expert while working at EMI.
I think so, and that's certainly one of the things I remember about him is the extremely simple way in which he could present some concept of aerials, receivers, and you know, things would suddenly all come clear to you, simply because he refused to, you know, become too involved in the sort of step-by-step details of something. He'd suddenly want to check up on it with a fairly simple bit of physics, you see.
Cut out all the trappings and
that's right,
get to the
and
basic.
Really get to the nub of the matter and say, well, you know, this can't be right because you end up with an infinite temperature or something equally silly. So let's forget that and let's get back to reality.
Yes, many people have told me similar things. Well, thank you very much.
Okay.
There's the interview with Fred Lahaney on 13th March, 78.